Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. After accusing the CIA of lying for the past 8 years, House Democrats request the administration broaden access to intelligence briefings. Unemployment rose to a record high of 9.5% last month, and the White House announced a deal with the nation's hospitals to help contain costs for a new health care plan. Joining me for this week's Friday News Roundup, E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post, Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine, and Dante Cini of the Christian Science Monitor. Welcome to you all. Good morning.
Morning. Good morning.
You can join us, too, as always, 1-800-433-8850. drshow@wamu.org is our email address. Lots happening on the economy. 9.5% unemployment, 467,000 new jobless. Obama's polls start to slip a little bit, particularly in the state of Ohio. GOP stepping up at the tax on the jobless recovery. Karen, what does this all amount to?
Well, what this has done, I think, is brought a lot more focus to the stimulus package. And, you know, on the one hand, Republicans are saying that this shows that it is not working. On the other hand, those who argue that the problem with the stimulus package was that it wasn't big enough and that we ought to be, you know, looking at another one. So the administration has found itself in the middle of this debate, fueled a bit by Vice President Biden's acknowledgement, one of these classic Washington gaffes where it's, you know, you tell the truth and as a result, your boss has to walk it back, that they had misread the economy going into this.
Well, I mean, but isn't this on the level of spreading vicious truth? I
exactly.
Mean, they said the unemployment rate would hit 8%. It's 9.5.
I mean, exactly.
That qualifies as a misread.
But nonetheless, the president felt compelled subsequently to say, yes, but there's not a single thing we would have done differently. So you're right. This comes as polls are showing people are feeling less confident and about both the president and his policies, and that, you know, but nobody knows what you do next.
EJ, the Republicans think they found an issue. John Boehner, a Republican leader in the House, managed in the space of one sentence this week to use the words tax, spend, China, Middle East, kids, and grandkids. They really think that, particularly in the industrial Middle West, which has lagged behind in the recovery, and of course is also key political battlegrounds, they found an issue, have they?
Well, if you are the party out of power and unemployment goes up to 9.5%, you have an issue. I mean, we all remember, or at least we're all old enough to remember the elections in 1982 where unemployment hit 10% right before the 82 midterm elections, and the Republicans lost a lot of seats, though
20,
they preserved
26 seats in the House. Yeah,
yeah, although they preserved their majority. So that I think the revival of the Republican Party depends less upon what they do than on what happens in the economy. I just think that's true. You've got a bunch of problems here. One is you had this struggle to get some bipartisan agreement on the stimulus that actually contained its size. It included stuff that didn't stimulate at all, like right. fixing minimum tax on the alternative minimum tax, which did nothing for the economy. So now you probably had a smaller stimulus than you needed. So you've got the economy growing more sluggishly. But given the Republicans' emphasis on we've already got too much big government already, a lot of Democrats, even in their heart of hearts, would like to do a second stimulus, are reluctant to join the issue. And the administration is hoping that things turn around enough so they don't have to rejoin that issue.
Now, Dante, you had Joe Biden going to Ohio and mm-hmm. saying, look, we have spent out about $99 billion out of a $767 billion package. This is a long-term issue.
Right.
You got to have some patience. Talk about the economics here. Is the stimulus package making any difference given the continued spike in unemployment?
I mean, it's very early. And mm-hmm. I mean, in a sense, Joe Biden's right. I mean, he says that, look, we said this thing was going to take 18 months. The thing is, one of the original arguments was we need to get the money out quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And when you we look at the numbers, and they're scary stuff. I mean, in the next week or so, we're going to get the next set of foreclosure numbers. And we've watched with my project, you know, the foreclosures kind of jumping into these areas it wasn't originally. And it's not, you know, the housing crisis kind of started us on this, mm-hmm. you know, the bubble burst and kind of ticked off the recession. But it may be getting to the point now where the housing crisis isn't really fixable. the housing crisis is a function of unemployment, and that really means that the recession is longer term, and that may have to do with the way they misread the economy.
Well, can you? People say, EJ pointed out that in order to get the bill passed, the bill was perhaps smaller than some liberals wanted. But is it also true that it was larded with political favors, which limited the speed of the payout, and that less than $100 billion having already been spent?
Right. Well, and the other part of it was that, look, when Rahm Emanuel said you don't ever want to waste a crisis, I mean, it's a great line. But there's the, you know, what it really meant was the Obama administration was dealing with two problems, I think, they saw. One was getting the economy stimulated again. And the other is kind of long-term structural changes that need to happen in the U.S. economy that they were trying to change as well. Now, those things are – they're not going to be to put the money on.
Quickly, Karen, today we have news that GM is going to come out of bankruptcy quicker than anybody expected. Good news for the economy? Is this a sign that maybe there are some progress being made?
Well, I don't think this is much of a reflection on the economy, because I think at this point the auto industry story is so much the auto industry story. And it's I think a function of both the aid that was given them working, but also the fact that the company wants to get out from under the strictures of that.
As do a lot of Wall Street firms, too, who are paying back the money as quickly as possible. EJ, let's move on to the healthcare debate on Capitol Hill. This package of reforms, you've written a lot about it this week, going to cost $1 trillion by most estimates. Democrats on the Hill have not figured out how to pay for this yet.
Well, it's actually – my hunch is that if they do it right, it's going to have to cost more than $1 trillion. So it's really something big to pay for. You've got right now, broadly speaking, three bills floating out there. You've got the House bill, which is pretty close to what Obama would actually want. It's got a public option. People, as part of the a menu that people would have, you would have a government plan in there. The House hasn't been quite clear yet, but the House clearly doesn't want to have taxes on people's health care benefits. That's one of the big things dividing
Partly because
Democrats.
That would affect a lot of middle-class people, including a lot of unionized workers who have very generous health care packages.
And President Obama is very strongly on the record opposing that. Mm-hmm. He pilloried John McCain for proposing a broader version of that during the campaign. But so you got the House bill, which I think is going to move along. Then you got two. You've got a bill in the Senate and a phantom bill in the Senate. The bill that the HELP Committee, Health, Education, Labor and Pensions, has produced is fairly close to the House bill. If all you had to do was reconcile those two bills, you wouldn't have a problem. Then you got Max Baucus, the senator from Montana, chairman of the Finance Committee, out there negotiating endlessly. It's like the endless summer negotiation with Senator Chuck Grassley, a Republican. Baucus desperately wants an agreement with Grassley. A lot of the Democratic leadership and a lot of people in the White House are getting impatient with Baucus, saying, you know, we need a bill. We don't need an agreement with Chuck Grassley. And it's getting the whole process is behind the schedule Democrats hoped it would be.
But isn't it, Dante, one of the key questions here, do the Democrats in the Congress and the White House, do they craft a bill that can only pass with Democratic votes? They now have 60 in the Senate, with Al Franken now becoming the new senator from Minnesota. Or do they continue this path of trying to attract Republican votes? Have they made that decision yet?
I don't think they've. I mean, it seems like Max Baucus has made one decision. And you know, and Harry Reid has actually come out and said it, too. I think that they don't want to go it alone. I think that this is a pretty big, you know, this is a pretty big thing to have sitting out there with the midterms approaching. And I think they would like somebody to come along for the ride. I go out and I talk to people in places all across the country. This is the one issue that everybody is concerned about, and it affects different places in different ways. And there are all these upper middle class people. It's not just people in the factories. Like they are worried that whatever comes out will end up costing them more money, and taxing their, you know, Cadillac plans. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't want that.
I just wanted to back up to something, though, that EJ had said. The fact is, Max Baucus has the hardest job in his jurisdiction of anybody, which is how to pay for this. We have a House bill, yes, we do have, from the three committees, but they have not addressed how you pay for it. The Senate Help Committee bill does not really explain how much you're going to expand Medicaid or do any of that other stuff. I mean, these are both incomplete bills.
And also, Karen, EJ mentioned that on one hand, Democrats are trying to woo some Republicans, moderate Republicans, but there are also splits in Democratic ranks. And doesn't it show that when you have big majorities. That means Democrat. There are 40 conservative Democrats in the House called blue dogs from states like North Carolina. You have Democratic senators from North Carolina, from Colorado, from Nebraska. When you have a big majority, by definition, you have people who don't necessarily go along with party orthodoxy.
Right. They technically have 60 votes if they can manage to get Senator Kennedy and Senator Byrd there, who have been missing largely the last few months because of illness. But beyond that, if they do try to do this with Democratic votes, they probably have to do it under a parliamentary procedure called reconciliation. That creates all kinds of other problems. Among other things, if they decide to go it alone with Democrats that way, they've got to pay for this bill in 5 years, not 10. And that means a much, much smaller bill.
Or a bigger tax, which is also a political problem. Could I just say, I think that you've got different issues in the House and the Senate. The Democratic majority in the House is so big that they can lose a lot of conservative Democrats and still get a majority. Indeed, the leadership on a lot of issues has let a lot of those folks go because they want them to get reelected. The Senate is much more complicated because if they are trying to get it through with 60 votes, then they really need to hold most of their conservative members and add a couple of Democrats. But I think the choice here, other than failure, which is a possibility, is either a good bill that gets bipartisan support. That's ideal. Right. A good bill that they have to pass on their own. That's the second best choice. I think the worst option would be an inadequate bill that gets bipartisan support. And maybe the stimulus is a good lesson in that, that you're better off to get not to get bipartisanship to get a better bill.
But very quickly, before we take a break here, aren't we seeing the re-emergence of a very old adage? It's very easy to spend money on Capitol Hill, very hard to raise taxes to pay for a lot of these bills, and they still have not gotten an answer yet.
No, that's absolutely right, and that you've got a real splits on whether, for example, some senators want to use the employer deduction, others want to go elsewhere for money.
We're going to be back with your comments, your calls, and more Roundup right after this. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. Friday News Roundup, we have E.J. Dion. He's a Washington Post columnist. He also teaches at Georgetown and is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Karen Tumulty is a reporter for Time Magazine. She also blogs, a very popular blog, at time.com/swampland. And Dante Cheney is director of the Christian Science Monitor's Patchwork Nation blog. And you can join our conversation at 1-800-433-8850 or drshow@wamu.org. Dante, one of the issues that came up this week is the latest chapter in a long-running feud between Democrats in Congress and the CIA. Mm-hmm. And the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Congressman Reyes from Texas, renewed charges that we had heard earlier this year from Speaker Pelosi that the CIA had concealed information from Congress. They had lied was the word he used.
Yep.
The new head of the CIA, Leon Panetta, a former member of the House and a very close associate of Nancy Pelosi's, went up to the House to try to mend fences. What happened?
Well, he went into a closed door meeting with them and told them that, in fact, that the CIA had been dishonest with the Congress from 2001 till just a few months ago. You know, and you know, the letter.
Dishonest over what?
Well, dishonest over interrogation tactics, for one, which is obviously what the Nancy Pelosi, which obviously goes back to Speaker Pelosi. And it, but the, we don't really know exactly what he said. All we know is we know in the letter that came out this week that he did confirm that they misled Congress. And they say in one case they outright lied. They say only one case that they know of. You know, is this all just cover? Is this all end up being just cover for Nancy Pelosi until we get to the actual what was in that meeting? And I don't know if we'll ever really know that unless he's willing to tell us, or they're willing to tell us.
But Karen, there's also a legislative issue here, in part because of all of this turmoil and over how the Congress is briefed by the CIA. There's a provision in the House Intelligence Bill which the Obama administration has threatened to veto, which would mandate much wider briefings from members of Congress. Update us on that.
Well, what would happen is right now they have something called the Gang of Eight, which is basically the chairman and ranking members of the intelligence committees who get briefed on everything. What this would do would expand this to the full membership of the committees, which is more like 40 people. As the obvious thing is, with 40 people, you have a much greater danger of leaks than you do with a smaller group. So the administration is threatening to veto this. But the reason for this is that there has been so much back and forth over just exactly what this smaller group had been briefed on with respect to interrogation techniques, torture, waterboarding. Did they know about it or did they not? And you hear conflicting claims from that.
And it's also true, EJ, this is another good example of how Democrats, highly critical of a lot of CIA tactics, and but when they are in the executive office, there's an impulse to defend executive power and privilege, even when it goes against some of their other ideas.
It's true, being in the executive changes your view on some questions. Leon Panetta is such a fascinating figure here. Yeah. It's worth remembering he started out his political life as a liberal Republican. And right. He is a classic big tent, take everybody's views into account guy.
Head of the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department.
Under Nixon, and then resigned because he didn't like the policies they were pursuing and became a Democrat. And he is really trying to do two things at once here that are very difficult. On the one hand, he wants to lead the CIA. He wants to defend their interests, and he wants credit as CIA leader. On the other hand, he is a person of the House. He does respect congressional prerogatives. He is, as you pointed out, a friend of Nancy Pelosi's, and he probably, you know, we don't know all the facts here, but he probably does think the CIA in the past misled Congress, and he is desperately trying to hold these two things together, and he's very good at doing that, but this is a real challenge to his skills.
He has three different constituencies. He has the agency he heads, he has his friends on Capitol Hill where he once served, and he has the president who appointed
him. Exactly, and he's trying to walk this line, and I think the explosion this week, or the modest tremor anyway, suggests that it's not an easy thing to do. But I think it's going to push people to find out what actually happened, which is always useful.
Right. I think, you know, it's interesting. It's not surprising that ultimately when you become president and the administration would want to, you know, release information about what exactly the intelligence branches of the government are doing to fewer number of people. I think that the interesting thing is how this is going to play, I think, with the left out there in the blogosphere and on the web. Because this, in some ways, goes against the, you know, the general openness idea. You know, there's openness and there's openness. That's the thing.
But as we were discussing, when you're the executive, there are certain impulses that come with having that job.
And you are commander in chief. I mean, you do have some responsibilities.
Karen, let me turn to another political story. It actually broke just minutes after the Friday News Roundup ended a week ago, but it has continued to reverberate through political circles here. In Washington and throughout the country. And that, of course, was the surprise announcement by Governor Palin of Alaska, not only that she would not run again, but that she would resign within weeks. A week out here now, what's the fallout? What's the bottom line and significance of this announcement that you can tell from now?
Well, I think that the second question is, why did she do this? And I don't think we are still quite to an answer yet. Was this just because, and reporters I've talked to in Alaska who've covered her for a long time say they just think she just got fed up with it. And they are uncertain whether she is going to pursue the presidency or much of a political career at all from here on out. But it also could be to go out and lay the groundwork for a run for president in 2012. So I just, you know, the degree to which Sarah Palin has become a Rorschach test, I think for anybody who's involved or even interested in politics is just fascinating.
EJ, do you think she has helped or hurt her possible candidacy for president?
I don't see how you can watch that performance last Friday and conclude anything but that she's hurt herself. It was remarkable how kind of incoherent, jumping from subject to subject, she was. And the Rorschach test that Karen refers to, I think, is most interesting among Republicans themselves. So you don't expect Democrats to like Sarah Palin. Right. Republicans are really bitterly divided. There are some who say this woman is totally unprepared to be president, and then she has her defenders out there. I think she's got a great future, not in politics, but writing conservative bestsellers, TV shows, maybe Joe the Plumber and Sarah Palin on Fox, and giving speeches. I would be shocked if she is ever, completely shocked if she's ever president of the United States.
Although, Dante, she continues to have strong support among conservative Republicans, particularly religious conservatives. There is a base there if she wants to run.
She does. There's no question. I am of the opinion that she's a very interesting person. And if you write a story about her, and it'll get on the web, and I guarantee you'll get a lot of clicks.
Yes.
But you know, the bottom line is I think her constituency is fairly small. Really, it is very fierce. But it's small, and I'm not really sure what ultimately it means. I do think politically, I agree with EJ. It's a really hard. I mean, hey, there are a lot of great, you know, comebacks in American politics, but this is going to be awfully hard. And I don't know if she did run again. I don't think she's obviously not. I don't think she'd ever want the Veep slot again. And I could never see her. I just can't see her getting the Republican
nomination. And a fierce minority is the perfect definition of a successful talk show host
it's
audience.
Absolutely
and
true.
That's why
right.
I think but she's got that future.
But not necessarily 51%
exactly
of the electorate
right.
in
exactly
an election. A very different constituency. Karen, another political story this week that continues to plague Republican Senator Enten of Nevada. Admitted an affair with the wife of a staff member. Now it comes out yesterday that his parents, who are quite wealthy, gave gifts close to $100,000 to this family. Implications that this was hush money or a payoff. Senator Enten continues to insist that he's going to stay in the Senate. What do we know now?
Well, we also have another figure being brought into this, which is his Senate colleague, Tom Coburn, who apparently was counseling him throughout this and disputes what has been alleged, which is that Coburn suggested that he pay her off, essentially. Senator Coburn is saying he is not going to talk about this because he was acting in his capacity as a physician and counselor to Senator Enten, which is sort of a difficult argument to make given that he is an obstetrician not a gynecologist. But it's I think yet another sort of summer soap opera that, you know, is again, this is not the storyline the Republican Party wants or needs at this moment.
And to go back to something we were saying earlier, EJ, the Republican Party, given this run of bad stories, including Governor Sanford of South Carolina, another story which continues to bubble out there, trying very hard to change the conversation to be, and the one word you heard this week and will continue to hear from Republicans is jobs.
Right. I think two of the happiest people in the country about all of this are Mitt Romney, whose chances of getting the Republican nomination have improved, and also Tim Pawlenty of Minnesota, who got rid of the problem of having to deal with the recount. Al Franken's now seated and has all of this. You have kind of Enten and Governor Sanford spelling each other as being at the center of the news. I think with Enten, I think a politician can survive a sex scandal, but when it becomes a sex and money scandal, which is this has now become, it gets a lot more complicated.
Let me ask you about another name in the news this week, EJ. You've been around Washington a long time. The death at 93 of Robert McNamara, Secretary of Defense under President Kennedy, then under Lyndon Johnson. And he tried very hard in the later years of his life to apologize for the Vietnam War. And yet when you read the obituaries, people were not accepting the apology in some ways. I mean, the word that kept coming up was haunted.
He was haunted by it for his entire life. And it was fascinating to watch the reactions because you have all kinds of, you know, certain conservatives who were critical of McNamara saying, well, this is what happens when an abstract kind of intellectual tries to apply his theories. You had a lot of people on the left who have been critical of him since the Vietnam War started. And he had a very complicated relationship with his own past because he kind of apologized for it, but he also wanted to defend himself. Human beings right. like to do that. And so I think this is one issue. I don't like the word closure as a general proposition. I think this is one issue where we're never going to fully reach closure.
In Fog of War, Errol Morris's
brilliant
movie. Yeah. And it's just clear that it's
this is a documentary about that features long interviews with McNamara.
Yeah, and it really is. It's McNamara's life. You see a little bit of his early life, and it's really him talking about the Vietnam War and decisions, and a little bit of World War II and Curtis LeMay, all sorts of interesting stuff in there. But he clearly, you know, he could not apologize for it, and he was trying to say, look, we did the wrong thing, but you have to understand the situation, and it was the box we were trapped in. And I thought the most interesting thing reading the obits this week was, we have come to this point in American culture, it seems to me, when somebody dies, we go through a big hagiographic period, and we've done it this week with Michael Jackson. Well, but not for Robert McNamara.
It's interesting when you mention Michael Jackson. When Barack Obama was in Russia, a meeting with Vladimir Putin and other Russian leaders talking about nuclear weapons that could affect the entire world, all the news led with Michael Jackson's funeral.
Well, because I forgot that, but it was something like 1 in 6 Americans actually sat down and watched the whole funeral. I was doing an interview on BBC Monday night, and I was at their studio, and they were going wall-to-wall coverage. I mean, this is it was like Princess Diana.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to some emails of folks, EJ. We have Robin in Frederica, Delaware, I believe that is. Why is it that George Bush had 8 years to mess everything up? President Obama only has 6 months to fix it. When does the economy become Obama's economy?
That's a great question. And I think that amnesia is the greatest enemy of the Obama administration, not the Republican Party at this point. That if you talk to people in the Obama administration, they say, my God, we inherited an economy that was about to go off the cliff.
Yeah.
And that we've pulled it back from the cliff. We're in bad shape, but we could be in much worse shape. But it's very hard politically to posit a catastrophe that didn't happen as something that everybody should be proud of avoiding. And so I think that Obama's got a big base, just like Ronald Reagan did, and that writer reflects it. And I think he's got 40%+ of Americans who are going to stick with him for a long time. Mm. The real question is, the folks in the middle, how long before they start blaming Obama? I think he's got more time, but it's not as much time as he probably deserves.
And we saw in the polls this week, Dante, the Quinnipiac poll in Ohio, where not only was there significant slippage of overall ratings, but particularly among independents, the people that EJ's talking about, disillusioned. And one of the things that Biden kept saying in Ohio was, we've saved jobs.
Right.
Look at the police and firemen. But it's a very hard thing to capsulize.
It's an incredibly difficult argument to make. And the other thing is, we have this in Patchwork Nation, we break the country into these types. And this one type we have is called moneyed burbs. And it's kind of these wealthy suburban areas around the cities. That's where Obama won the election. He won those places by like 11 percentage points. Kerry had only won them by like fractions of a percentage point. Those are the swing voters. And he you're right. I think EJ's right. He does have this really solid mid-40 group of people that isn't going anywhere, but he's going to have problems with those people. And they're key to the success of his presidency.
The other swing voters, I think, are, even though he often lost in places dominated by white working class, lower middle class folks, he cut into that vote.
Absolutely.
Because they were mad about the economy. And those are the folks who are going to recover, see their situation improve last.
Later.
They're going to
Absolutely.
Be at the end of the line. And that's, I think, a real political problem for Democrats. It's what hurt them in the 94 elections, and they're desperate to avoid that happening again.
And that, of course, is also one of the reasons that, to pick up on what we were talking about earlier in terms of financing the health care bill. Well, one of the reasons why so many Democrats are so resistant to taxing health care benefits, because that would be an issue that could really hurt with some of those voters you're talking about.
Right. I think there's a real danger here. If you go back to the bill back in the 80s to provide catastrophic coverage for seniors, which everybody said this is a great idea, well, the taxes kicked in earlier than anybody saw the benefits. In 2 years, it was repealed. I think the Democrats are desperate to make sure that people see some benefit out of this health care reform before they start feeling the costs. If you do it the other way around, it may be more fiscally responsible, but it's politically very risky.
Yeah, something concrete.
Karen, let me read you this email from Reed in Havana, Florida. Karen was right, he writes, to point out that Republicans have indeed been taking shots at the president's policies, but I have not heard or any alternatives to the policies. Republican stance seems to be criticized, but don't go out on a limb by suggesting another way. Does the panel think between now and the election time next year, Republican candidates will offer a viable alternative besides tax cuts?
Actually, I'm not at all sure. I don't know that, again, the parallel you might go back to here is when President Bush, the most recent President Bush, proposed overhauling the Social Security system and bringing in private accounts. The Democrats decided on that one that it was better for them just to sit it out and watch what happens. So the Republicans, you know, unless the public is actually demanding alternatives of them, which I don't believe it is at the moment, I think they're making the calculation that it's better to just sort of sit this one out and see if Obama self-destructs.
And no fingerprints.
Right.
Right. Quickly, Larry from Farmington Hills writes, now that GM is out of bankruptcy, Dante, do you foresee the government unduly pressuring GM to build even more fuel-efficient cars at the expense of their popular trucks and SUVs?
My popular truck and SUV, the popular truck and SUV argument, I just think in the end, will there be undue pressure? I don't think they will, but I think ultimately the popular trucks and SUVs are going to become less popular. Look, we're in a period now where gas prices are a little low. They're just not going to stay there. I mean, eventually they're going to go up.
They're going up a little bit.
Yeah,
in
right.
My neighborhood. Dante Cheney is of the Christian Science Monitor. Karen Tumulty of Time, E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post. We'll be back with your calls and your questions. Stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Friday News Roundup. China's president leaves the G8 summit to deal with ethnic violence in the nation's western region. Bomb attacks kill dozens in Iraq and Afghanistan. World powers disagree on targets for greenhouse gas emissions. The Diane Rehm Show next hour. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts. I'm sitting in today for Diane. And on our first hour of the news roundup, the domestic portion, E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post, Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine, Dante Cheney of the Christian Science Monitor. And we're going to go to some callers here in Erin in Springfield, Missouri. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah. Hello, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. The question that I wanted to ask is, why, when the media talks about health care, do they never mention that in this country we pay per person about twice what other westernized countries that cover everyone pay for health care? That's per person, not per insured person.
Okay.
I just wondered why that's never mentioned.
Well, let's talk about it. Thanks for the question, EJ.
Well, I think the president certainly mentions that sort of thing a lot, and I think you're right. It is a central issue. If you look at the other wealthy democracies, they have systems where two things are true. The government pays a larger share of the freight to cover everybody, and overall costs are low. Much lower than ours, and that Peter Orszag, who is the president's budget director, believes that it is possible not so much to bring down the total cost, but to control future growth, bend the curve, is their cliche. And I think they're right about that. So I'm very sympathetic to what lies behind that phone call.
Yeah.
We also have another email from an emailer in Maryland. Am I missing something? Our listener writes, but it doesn't seem that the administration is trying to sell the fact that Americans will have to make sacrifices to get the health care we say we want. For example, higher taxes. Why aren't they talking about sacrifices, Karen?
That is also a good point. I mean, it is, the line has been, basically that this is something that the improvements can be gained through greater efficiency, mm-hmm. through electronic record keepings, through all sorts of things like that, because, people don't want to hear about sacrifice. And they also, by the way, don't want to hear about losing something they already have. And that makes them very, very nervous. And, it's one of the reasons, for instance, that taxing your current benefits is now basically run out of steam as an idea, I think.
Some of this goes back to the Reagan administration when he was going to pay for his tax cuts with cutting waste, fraud, and abuse. And it was this is a very similar theme.
And by the way, the other thing that you don't hear a lot about is the concept that, there may in other countries, people who are wanting treatment sometimes don't get it and cannot have quite the selection of drugs that we have in this country.
And there's also the question of Dante, of the burden that expensive healthcare systems place on the economies of Western Europe. I mean, there is a lot of arguments that Europe has a lot of these social services that they can't quite afford anymore.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the thing that Karen just said too, but there is this the constant theme you hear from people is, the healthcare system is really messed up, but it's a devil you know and devil you don't know argument. It's like, but what they'll do will be worse. And also the idea that it may be messed up, but it's still the best. Just the line is always, it's still the best healthcare system in the world. So that's what people believe.
Speaking of other countries, we have a caller from Berlin. Carolyn is on the air. We're delighted to have you with us. What's on your mind?
It goes back to something you were talking about before. That you were saying, talking about Obama's ratings. And I get really upset when I hear the media, I listen to mostly at NPR, talk about Obama as if it was up to Obama to pull it out. He didn't campaign on Yes, I Can. He campaigned on Yes, We Can. And there's an awful lot that we can be doing. We should be out there, fighting for his policies and things, and just sitting back and waiting for him to walk his tightrope and fall or not fall, it just sends me up a wall.
Okay, thanks for your call, EJ.
Well, it's an interesting issue the caller raises, because what you haven't seen yet is Obama unleash the 13 million folks he's got on his mailing list. My friend Harold Meyerson wrote a column about this week. You wonder, at what point is this Obama political machine going to kick in and try to do for healthcare what they did for Barack Obama himself? Just to go back very briefly on that sacrifice question, ultimately, liberals are going to have to make the world safe for tax increases again. The whole climate has been anti-tax for a long time, and we're not going to be able to balance a budget and do things we need without tax increases. But it's very hard to ask people to sacrifice in a downturn when they think they've already given up a lot, and they're right.
When you speak about the liberal interest groups, though,
I'm not talking about liberal interest groups. I'm talking about philosophical liberals who actually believe in the government doing some things.
Well, you talked about the Obama machine, and certainly they will make an effort to use and utilize this enormous potential power of the mailing list and everything. But some of the liberal interest groups that have been allied with Obama, MoveOn.org and others, have started campaigns to put pressure on some of the conservative and moderate Democrats in the Senate, Mary Landrieu in Louisiana, for example. And Obama himself is basically saying, lay off. There seems to be a split between these groups and Obama.
I have no way of knowing if what I'm about to say next is true, but I believe that Obama publicly is going to say that because he has to say that. But it's quite clear that some of these liberal interest groups have pushed at least a few moderate senators toward support for a public option in the healthcare system. So my hunch is the administration is actually a bit more ambivalent about this than those words from Obama suggest.
Let's turn to Scott in Dallas, Texas. Scott, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks. If you want to give me the option of having to appeal my medical case to a bureaucrat who's disinterested, or somebody who has a fiduciary duty to make a profit off of me and has a vested interest in denying me coverage, give me the bureaucrat. Secondly, y'all need to investigate USAA. It's a GSE that's run with, doesn't get any government money. They do financial services and insurance. I've been a member for 20 years. Something that's available to military officers, active and retired, and they have the highest customer service, the great care. They're very flexible. My credit card rate is still at 12.9, even though I've had problems paying them. They're very flexible. We don't need rainmakers to be bankers. We need actuaries to be bankers, and they should get a civil service income. And that's where all the waste goes in health care and in everything else. And do an investigation on USA and see what the customer satisfaction rating is of that versus GEICO and its competitors. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Scott. Karen.
Well, on Scott's earlier argument, which was that basically he's arguing here for a single payer system, government financed, government run system, which is, by the way, the model in most of the other industrialized countries in the world. That is the one option that is not on the table in this debate. The president has said, if I were designing a system from the beginning, yes, I'd consider this, but we're not going to. And this has been a source of great frustration, I think, to many on the left, because they think that ultimately, that this is the model that would work.
Well, and this is partly a political decision to try to fend off the charges of, quote, socialized medicine, that this is the real plan of the Democrats. Isn't this partly a strategic decision?
Right, which is one of the reasons you hear Max Baucus and others at every opportunity saying, no, we are designing a uniquely American system.
Let's turn to Pete in Rochester, New York. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, Pete.
Actually, it's Pete in Rochester.
Okay, go ahead.
I find it interesting that we're having a hard time finding the money to fund health care reform. We can fund, first of all, we already spend more than enough money to cover everybody. All right, we can realize $400 billion of savings by going to a single-payer health care system, one that you've all mentioned, that the rest of the industrialized countries in the world have come to the conclusion it's the only efficient, effective, and moral thing to do. But we in this country seem to think that we can figure out a better way. Obviously, we can't.
Thank you very much, Pete. Dante?
Going to say, it's interesting when people are saying, where do we find the money to pay for this? It's worth noting that this bill has to pass under some very strict budget rules. And it's going to be, the arithmetic on this is basically, it has to balance itself over 10 years in what it costs the federal government, which means you could be doing things out there that are saving money for the healthcare system writ large that you're going to get no credit for because it doesn't filter down to the Medicare and Medicaid programs. So, that is, I think, when people see these numbers and they're going, wait, there's all this waste in the system. Can't we just squeeze it out there? You can't.
Well, but, I was going to say, the thing about the single payer plan is ultimately it's just where the political power is in the country. You're not going to get people who have. Look, the people who have good plans are the people who vote, and they're the people who. I mean, now this is changing obviously as we have higher and higher unemployment, but we look at uninsured rates in different kinds of parts of the country, and the places with the most uninsured are these places with a lot of immigrants. So you go down, you talk to them about what's going on. And they will tell you that I had talked to a small business owner, tried to offer people insurance, the people who work for her, and she was going to give, she was going to cover 90% and have them pay 10. She couldn't get them to go for it. She couldn't get 50 out of 90 people to vote for that. And you talk to the people who don't have insurance, they'll say, like, well, why would I do that? I'll just go to the hospital when I really have a problem. But then when you ask them, if you were, what do you think about health care reform? They're like, look, if the government requires me to get a health care plan, that would be really be a good thing. I'll do it. But they're not going to do it on their own. So there's just one end of the population wants one thing, the other one wants another.
Which is why we'll probably get some kind of a mandate in here, possibly both on employers and individuals. The caller's right that there's money in the system to pay for an expansion of health care. And some of the money is going to come for that because the person who shows up at that emergency room is paid for from something. So there is something to that. But to expand coverage will probably cost more on top of that. The whole idea of the public plan is to move gradually. If we're going to get to single payer, if single payer advocates are right that that's a logical place to go, then the public plan allows that to happen in a gradual way. I think the worry, even among some single payer advocates, is that it would be too wrenching a change to go from here to there in a single step. And that's part of the beauty of this public plan, if it ever happens.
Let's talk to Clodie, is it, in Bethesda, Maryland?
It's Claude.
Claude, please go ahead. Welcome.
About health insurance and the whole system here. I grew up in Canada. I'm now a naturalized citizen here. I have been for a little while. I've lived here for about 20 years. One of your commentators just said that, you know, we don't want to change. The change would be too wrenching if we went from the current system to a single-payer system. Canada did it in the 60s. And, yeah, it was difficult, but they did it, and they're really glad. I mean, I read newspapers regularly, and people say, we're really glad that we did it. Yeah, it was hard, but we've benefited a lot. The Diane Rehm Show had Representative Henry Waxman on the show on Tuesday, and he kept saying that single-payer was controversial. It's not controversial. Over 70% of the population here wants it. It's radical. It's not radical. Would anyone use radical to describe Canada in any way?
Bless you for that.
Thank you very much. Go ahead, Dante.
Well, I think that, you know, there are differences, and there are obviously, I hate to say it, there are cultural differences between Americans and Canadians, which there are. And I do think that it might have been easier in the 1960s than it would be to do now. I will say, if the unemployment rate keeps going up, it will be easier to get some kind of reform.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I want to ask you about two other very quick stories that came up this week. Karen, at one point, the General Services Administration reported having tested the mechanisms for security at a lot of federal buildings and came up with the alarming news that a lot of them were pretty porous. What was that story about?
Well, basically, they sent people into 10 high-security federal buildings with bomb-making components and found out that none of them got stopped. And I believe in at least a couple of instances, the security personnel in the buildings actually went and unlocked restrooms so that these people could get in and assemble these bomb-making components. So I think this was a really interesting test and a gigantic wake-up call.
Any implications here? Did the Obama administration talk about tightening any procedures or that they have in place?
Well, I think at this point, you know, the report just came out this week, but I suspect that, you know, those of us who have gotten accustomed to taking off our shoes at airports are going to be doing a lot more at a lot more different kinds of federal buildings.
I mean, this sort of comes at a time, Dante, when some of the security procedures have actually been eased, airports being one example.
Right. The other thing I think when you look at this is it's a sign of how quickly, I mean, look, when you go talk to people, everybody is focused on the economy, healthcare now too, because that's related to the economy. But how quickly, if there was an attack in this country, if one of these things happened, how quickly the tone of the conversation could switch.
And EJ, another issue that got a lot of attention, certainly here in Washington, but around the country, involved your newspaper, The Washington Post, which had decided, given the fact that it and the Christian Science Monitor and Time Magazine and everybody else is under enormous economic pressures, to create a series of private dinners at the home of the new publisher, Catherine Weymouth, between policymakers and some journalists. And a flyer went out promising inside access, and immediately there was a huge outcry, including a lot of people in the Washington Post newsroom saying that their own newspaper had made a mistake, and then the publisher, Catherine Weymouth, took the unusual step last Sunday of publishing her own statement in your newspaper, disowning the project. Bring us up to date on that.
Well, first of all, I should say I know nothing more about this whole thing than anyone else sitting at this table. Secondly, as a general proposition, I am sympathetic to news organizations trying to find legitimate new revenue streams because they need them. This was clearly a mistake. I think my colleague Dan Baltz put it well. He said, everyone knows the dinners were a bad idea. If anyone didn't know that before, they know it now. And that's what the publisher of The Washington Post essentially said herself.
Karen, a lot of talk about where the line should be as news organizations search for new sources of revenue. What's the discussion in a place like Time?
Well, Time does sponsor big events, and so does the parent company Time Incorporated, the magazines. But I think that, and I do honestly don't know what the sort of corporate sponsorship deals are, but these are generally open to the public. And I think that is one kind of disciplining mechanism to make sure what the Post was doing was essentially blatantly selling seats at the table with not only administration officials, but their own journalists. And that is where I think they got themselves into trouble.
I mean, as Karen points out, Dante, New York Times has full-page ads advertising their seminars and their discussions, but it's all designed to bring the public in, very different from doing it privately and behind closed doors.
Right, yeah, doing it privately and at the publisher's home. I think that as bad as things are in journalism right now, if you want to see things get worse, have one of these parties, have somebody walk in with a hidden camera, shoot the whole thing, and then put it on YouTube and talk about who was talking to whom. It's just, it's bad.
And, you know, we saw this, Karen, at the Los Angeles Times, where Truth and Labeling, you used to work, your husband works, where they had a problem a few years ago where they had money-making schemes, special editions, relationships with advertisers. So this is not a new problem. It continues.
This was a special supplement they had done that had been partially financed by the Staples Center. But I got to tell you, that looks like, you know, nothing. That pales in comparison to this. And I think it's a reflection of how much more dire the economic times are.
Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine, Dante Cini of the Christian Science Monitor, E.J. Dion of the Washington Post. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, and thanks so much for spending your Friday morning with us.